Forward. I seldom have as much pleasure in reading nonfiction as I do in a poem or a story. I can admire a well-made essay, but I'd rather follow a narrative than a thought, and the more abstract the thought, the less I comprehend it. Philosophy inhabits my mind only as parables, and logic never enters it at all. Yet my grasp of syntax, which seems to me the logic of a language, is excellent. So I imagine that this limitation in my thinking is related to my abysmal mathematical incompetence, my inability to play chess or even checkers, perhaps my incomprehension of key in music. There seems to be a firewall in my mind against ideas expressed in numbers and graphs rather than words, or in abstract words such as sin or creativity. I just don't understand, and incomprehension is boredom. So the nonfiction I read is mostly narrative, biography, history, travel, and science in its descriptive aspect. Geology, cosmology, natural history, anthropology, psychology, etc., the more specific the better. And not only narrativity, but the quality of the writing is of the first importance to me. Rightly or not, I believe a dull, inept style signals poverty or incompleteness of thought. I see the accuracy, scope, and quality of Darwin's intellect directly expressed in the clarity, strength, and vitality of his writing, the beauty of it. This means I've set myself an awfully high standard when it comes to writing nonfiction. And if it isn't narrative, it's going to be hard work, and hard for me to judge as good or bad. Writing fiction or poetry is natural to me. I do it, want to do it, am fulfilled in doing it, the way a dancer dances or a tree grows. Story or poem is spun directly out of my entire self, and so I consider myself without question the primary judge of its accuracy, honesty, and quality. Writing talks or essays, however, is always more like doing schoolwork. It's going to be assessed for style and content, and rightly so. Nobody knows better than I do what my stories are about, but my essays may be judged by people who know a lot more than I do about what I'm talking about. Fortunately, studying French and other Romance literatures, I got good training in scholarship and in writing critical prose, which gave me some confidence. Unfortunately, I also showed a gift for the snow job, not the kind that buries fake facts under a blizzard of statistics, but the stylistic snow job, expressing incomplete ideas with such graceful confidence that they are perfectly convincing until examined. After all, a fluent style isn't altogether dependent on the thoughts it expresses. It can be used to skate over gaps in knowledge and conceal rickety joints between ideas. When I'm writing nonfiction, I have to be very aware of my tendency to let the words take their own course, leading me softly, happily, away from fact, away from rigorous connection of ideas, toward my native country, fiction and poetry, where truths are expressed and thoughts connected in an entirely different way. As I got old and my total store of energy began to shrink, I began to travel about to give speeches less often and less far, and was less willing to take on a big talk or essay topic that would eat up weeks or months of research, planning, writing, and rewriting. So there are fewer talks and essays in this book than in my earlier nonfiction collections, and proportionately more book reviews. A book review is usually pretty short, under 1,000 words, and naturally limited in topic. It has certain requirements of description, but allows a lot of leeway as to pronouncing judgment, even though it involves the writer's conscience pretty directly. It's an interesting and demanding form, and one can say a good deal in a review that has to do with wider matters, literary and otherwise. I like writing reviews, except when I dislike the book I'm reviewing. When it comes to reading reviews, of course the best is one that sends me right to the bookstore, but I also treasure a hatchet job well written and well deserved. The pleasure of reading a killer review of a bad book is guiltless. The pleasure of writing one, however, is darkened for me by all kinds of compunctions, fellow feeling for the author, shame at enjoying inflicting shame. All the same, so long as I've tried to understand what the author tried to do, and have no illusions of my critical infallibility, condoning inferiority isn't an option open to me. For this reason, the only real killer review in this book presented me with an intense problem. I had considerable respect for the author, but thought the book almost incredibly bad. I had no idea how to review it. I appealed to my friend, the novelist Molly Gloss, what to do. She suggested that I simply tell the plot. It was an excellent solution. Supply enough hemp, and the problem vanishes. As for what writing an essay or talk demands, the expense of time and energy on research, thinking out, rethinking, this of course varies according to the subject. One of the longer pieces in this book, Living in a Work of Art, was not written, as most of them were, as a talk to a group or on commission by a periodical, though it ended up happily in Paradoxa. It was something I wanted to write, purely on the principle of E.M. Forster's lady who said, "How do I know what I think till I see what I say?" It didn't take very much research, and once it got going, it was a pleasure to write. When I can use prose, as I do in writing stories, as a direct means or form of thinking, not as a way of saying something I know or believe, not as a vehicle for a message, but as an exploration, a voyage of discovery resulting in something I didn't know before I wrote it, then I feel that I am using it properly. So that one is probably my favorite of these pieces. I am often asked to deliver a message, and quite capable of doing so, but I seldom find it easy or particularly pleasant. One of the shortest pieces in the book is my speech on receiving the National Book Foundation Medal in 2014. I was informed in June that this honor had been awarded me, so long as I'd come to New York to get it and make an acceptance speech lasting not more than 7 minutes. I accepted with much hesitation. From June until November, I worked on that little talk. I rethought and replanned it, anxiously, over and over. Even on a poem, I've never worked so long and so obsessively, or with so little assurance that what I was saying was right, was what I ought to say. I was daunted, too, by the ingratitude of insulting the people who printed my books and were giving me an award. Who was I to spit in the publisher's punch bowl at the annual industry party? Well, I was, in fact, the one to do it. So I did it. I've never been so nervous before a speech since junior high school commencement. I've never been so surprised by an audience reaction, though the Amazon table sat predictably, glumly, mute. The viral flurry on the internet and my ensuing 15 Warhol minutes of celebrity status were encouraging. People do care about books. Some of them worry about capitalism. How much good it did in the long run is another question. But at least I ended up feeling that getting what I had to say said right in 6 minutes was entirely worth 6 months of work. This confirms my sense that I have been allowed to use my life well, in work that was worth the time spent on it. Many people might see my two principal occupations as incompatible, being a middle-class American intellectual, wife, housewife, mother of 3 children, and being a writer. I won't say that doing both jobs at once was easy, but I can report, from very late in the life in question, that I found some inevitable conflict, but no incompatibility between the two. Little abnegation was demanded, and no sacrifice of life for art or art for life. On the contrary, each nourished and supported the other so deeply that, looking back, they all seem one thing to me.